Actually, you can go right there.
And whenever you're ready for a break, if you just hit Control and 3,
using control, write that, control 3.
okay. So,
can we turn off some lights?
Sure.
So they can.
So today, as I mentioned last time, we are going to start with a guest lecture. Lee Ryan, many of you know Dr. Ryan, and she's an expert on neuroimaging. She's at Dr. PET and fMRI.
Thank you. I've never been all wired up to teach before. And a couple of you have taken my fMRI course, so you could be the ones up here teaching this, but I'll spare you. So today I'm going to, can we turn off some of the lights, please? Is that okay? All right. So today I'm going to go over the basics of fMRI and PET. And I have a lot of material, so who knows whether I'll get through it all. There's no requirement that we get through everything. You've read the chapters, I'm assuming, and so feel free to ask questions as we go along. I'm happy to do that, and just we'll talk about whatever interests you as well. So what we're going to talk about first of all is structural MRI and how it works, just a little bit. Obviously can't go into it in a lot of detail in here in the time that we have, and we'll talk about functional MRI and just briefly go over the various methods that you can use. I'm sure that you've been talking about a lot of them in John's class already. And then PET. We don't have a PET scanner here at U of A, so I used to do some PET imaging. The closest one we have is up in Phoenix. So it's available to researchers, but it's not really used. And the truth is that it's not used as much anymore for functional imaging as it once was. There's some interesting uses of it, but functional measurements are not really one of them anymore. But we'll talk about that a little bit just so that you have some idea of what it is. So I love this picture. This is the first magnetic resonance image of a brain. The authors called it a shadow of a brain, and it was published in 1980. So it wasn't that long ago. And within about 5 years, we went from that to the exquisite images of function, or of structure, not function yet. That took a long time after that, but of anatomy. So less than 5 years before this was, we went from this to really beautiful images that we'll look at later on that were used clinically. But people recognized right away that this was an exciting advancement and that it held a lot of promise to be able to look at the in vivo human brain in a relatively simple method. I'm sure how many of you have had an MRI? A whole bunch of you, and you've probably seen an MR machine. This is what it looks like. This is a 1.5 Tesla magnet. That's the one that is typically used for clinical imaging. We use a 3 Tesla magnet, and you can go up to about 7 Tesla. There's actually one 8 Tesla magnet for humans in use, but I wouldn't go in it. So most of the ones that are used for research are 3 or 4 Tesla, and so we have a 3 Tesla magnet. This is a very safe kind of imaging, as long as you follow some safety rules. It can be dangerous, but we won't get into that. And the reason is that it's really made up of just two simple things. An electromagnetic field, it happens to be in the, we're standing in one right now, right? And it's not electromagnetic, but it's a magnetic field, the Earth's gravitational field. And then the addition of radio frequency waves. And RF waves are pulsing through us at this very moment as we speak. That's why we can turn on a radio in the room and get a signal, right? And that's exactly what we use to make these images. So they're really simple components that get put together in very non-simple ways. MS, I like showing pictures of MS for a couple of reasons. Number one is because it was MS that put MRI on the map. It got it approved in the clinical trials. But it also was these images that gave me my PhD dissertation, because I did my first research on MS lesions and the placement of MS lesions, and nobody knew what what was going on with MRI and MS at the time, but it was useful for me. So the clinical trial started in 1983, and this was approved in an extraordinarily short period of time, less than two years later, actually, in the early part of 1985, the FDA approved this for use clinically. And the reason was really because of multiple sclerosis. The early studies showed that for every lesion that you could see on a CT scan, there were at least 10 or more that you could identify on an MRI scan. So the clinical utility of this as a diagnostic tool became blatantly obvious to everyone right away. And so it was fast-tracked to being approved. Of course, we were interested in it a lot because of these kinds of images, right, where we can use it to look at the function of the brain instead of at the anatomy of the brain. And this is just one paper from my lab in 2005. We're looking at actually differences, very subtle differences in the signal in MRI from these posterior regions, looking at a priming task where we showed people in the first pass some word, and then we either show it to them in the same format as before, that's the priming, same, or the priming with in a different format, same word but different format, and we can see that they both show priming in the signal in this region, but they show us subtle differences in the signal, and we actually got that difference in this region but not in other anterior regions, and so it gave us another piece of information beyond just RT and accuracy in terms of separating these the components of processes involved in these kinds of tasks and saying not only are there differences, but what regions of the brain might be mediating these different components of the task. So it can be very used very subtly, and that's what we're going to talk about most of all today, right? Okay, some basic things that you really need to think about when you're talking about any kind of functional imaging, and it's important when you're looking at the differences between MEG and PET and fMRI, so we'll talk about those. First of all, what is it actually measuring? It's not trivial to figure this out in fMRI to really understand what that signal is. We'll talk about it a little bit later on. And then a couple of other things that you want to know about your imaging method. The first one is contrast sensitivity. So how sensitive, how subtle can you get in capturing changes in the signal? If the signal is really, really small, and you don't have much sensitivity in your particular measure, it doesn't matter that you have something that has really wonderful spatial resolution or temporal resolution. If it doesn't have sensitivity to the actual signal change, it's going to be useless to you. So you have to understand what the limitations are in terms of what it can actually measure. That depends on whether you're talking about anatomical imaging or fMRI. So we can mention that. The spatial resolution, a lot of us in neuroscience are interested in what single neurons do. Well, there's no imaging method out there that can pick up on changes in the brain at that level. So the question is, what is the spatial resolution? What do you need in terms of spatial resolution? Because there's always a cost when you decrease the resolution, or actually increase the resolution. There's always a big cost involved. So do you really need to image at a really low resolution? So for example, some of the stuff that I do, I look in the hippocampus, right? It's my favorite place in the brain. I'm sure it is yours too, right? And it's a small structure, about 3 millimeters across, or 3 millimeters, about 20 millimeters across. So if I have a voxel size that's 3 millimeters, that gives me pretty decent resolution. Not great, because if I want to look at independent components of the hippocampus, that's not going to resolve it for me. But I can get pretty good measurements within the hippocampus. And I would want to go to small resolutions. So usually in there we go down to like 2 by 2 by 2 millimeters cubed for our voxel size. If I'm looking at the frontal lobe, what you get in these activation paradigms is huge regions of activation that spread across at least 20, maybe 30 millimeters or more of tissue. So there's no point in me going to these really, really small voxel sizes because I'm actually losing sensitivity. So I want to be able to play with this spatial resolution. It's something a lot of people don't think about when they're doing this imaging. So you want to know how small you can get it, but you don't always need it that small. You also need to know what the size of the actual signal is that you're trying to get at. And the last one is temporal resolution. How fast can you measure stuff? So again, if the change in the brain is on the order of hundreds of milliseconds, as we see, or even a few milliseconds, as we see in ERPs, fMRI is never going to be useful for us. But it turns out that the thing that we're actually measuring is really a pretty slow change. We'll talk about that. So it's the hemodynamic response. And so we have sufficient temporal resolution with fMRI to see that signal. But it's nowhere near what ERPers can look at. Okay, so the first one is to look at this contrast signal sensitivity. So these are two images here. They're actually the same image, but they've been toyed with so that this one has better contrast across two different types of tissue. You can see that pretty obviously here. Whereas this is the same image, but the contrast has been lowered. And what you can see here is that you get much better signal change or contrast across the gray matter. You can see the gray matter band on the outside of the brain and separate it from white matter, whereas in this image, there isn't as much. So we can do all kinds of things in MRI to change this contrast sensitivity based on what we actually want to see. Is it gray-white contrast? Is it brain CSF? Or maybe it's a lesion or a tumor, and we'll collect our images in different ways depending on what the important contrast is that we need for what we're doing. So that's the CNR, and it's very important. If you don't have enough contrast change across sensitivity across the two tissue types, or for example, in the kinds of changes in signal that we want to measure in functional MRI, then there's no point in doing this. So you need to know what the CNR actually is. Okay, in MR, what we also look at is a different kind of contrast. You can, when you hear people talking about what the contrast is in an MR image, what they're mostly talking about there are changes in the way that the images are collected so that you're sensitizing the image to a particular physical property of the nucleus. Which is sort of beyond what we're getting into, we're going to talk about today, but I think in some of the readings you probably read about T1 weighting, T2 weighting, T2 star weighting. So it's all the same nuclei, but as we collect the data, we can collect it in various ways so that it sort of highlights one of those particular properties, the relaxation properties of the hydrogen molecule. And you can get images that look really, really different from one another. So this one highlights the difference between brain and CSF. The CSF is very bright. The rest of the brain is dark, but you can see the little bits of CSF around the outside of the brain. And in this one, the CSF is dark, but you get much better contrast between the gray and the white. So we can play with those kinds of things. This is the image, by the way, that you would use for multiple sclerosis, because the lesions in MS show up very bright, the way that the CSF looks. And so you don't want to use it over here because this is kind of not this sort of light already. So you would use this T2 weighted image to do that kind of thing. So it depends on what you want to use it for. This is one that's very important to us in MRI, in fMRI, and that's the functional contrast to noise. So imagine that you have some signal happening that you know about. You show somebody a stimulus, and you expect, if it's visual, that the visual cortex is going to do something. Neurons are going to be firing back there. So you would expect some change in the signal. And we'll get at what that signal change actually is. But there's always background noise, particularly in a brain that is alive, because it's pulsating. There's lots of things that are changing. Every time you take a breath in, you get these waves of oxygenation within the brain, and then it drops back down again and back up. It's actually physically pulsating as well, so around, particularly around the large vessels. So there's all kinds of noise in there that comes from the physiology. There's also noise in our measurement. And so if we plot this background noise here, if our signal is this large and our noise is this large, then we have some likelihood of actually seeing that signal. But if we get into perhaps regions of the brain where there's more of this error, or we just don't have a scanner that's tuned very well, then what we might get is definitely a signal, but it's just so embedded in the noise that we can't differentiate the two. So this is signal. This is true signal to noise, or functional contrast to noise, that we are very concerned about in fMRI. And it's, I can tell you, in fMRI, it's really, really small as well. The spatial resolution is determined in MR by the size of the voxel. And the voxel size is some kind of square or elongated kind of rectangle of brain tissue that you are averaging over. And so it's very important to keep in mind how big that thing is. So in the old days, we used to do 6-millimeter sections of brain. And that's because the bigger the voxel, the more signal you get from it. But the downside is that, imagine if you take 6 millimeters of, doesn't seem like a lot, but it's a lot in terms of brain, take a big cube of this stuff and lay it on the brain. That's how wide apart they are. I don't know how far this apart is. Does it say on here? I don't know, but it looks pretty standard, maybe 5 millimeters apart with a skip in there or something. That's a lot of brain in between there. So every little voxel is being laid long ways in between here. And so what you're going to get in that voxel is not just maybe one tissue type. It might not all be gray matter, but it might actually be a little bit of gray matter here, a little bit of white matter, and maybe even some CSF. And so the signal that you get from that voxel is going to be determined by the total average of all the tissue types that are in there. So one reason to go to small to little tiny voxel size is that it decreases the likelihood that you have this problem, what we call, what's the term I'm looking for? Partial voluming, thank you. Partial voluming across different tissue types. Of course, now there's a trade-off. You have to, if you go to these small voxels, you're more likely to get a single type of tissue, but you lose signal instead. So we like to keep these as large as we can. And in anatomical imaging, we keep it really nice and small. So 1 millimeter in-plane resolution gives us really beautiful images. But we don't do anything close to that in fMRI. I'll show you a classic fMRI image, which might be somewhere around 2 to 3 millimeters in there. This is interesting because this goes from 8 millimeter in-plane resolution, which looks like a really terrible image, right? Doesn't look, you can sort of tell if you know that it's a brain, but it could be a football. And then you go to 4 millimeters and down to 2, and you can see that there's a huge increase in your ability to detect all of the different structures in there. But once you go down below that to 1.5 or 1 millimeter, really, after this, you really can't see the difference. The human eye can't detect the difference. So for just looking at these from a sort of clinical point of view, there's no real benefit of dropping the voxel size down any more than 1 millimeter in plane resolution. And so what we run at actually is a voxel that is 1 millimeter by 0.985 by 0.985. And that's it. And nobody would go lower than that unless you're doing a small animal, right? Then you have this little tiny mouse brain, and this would be huge. And so now you want to drop it down to on the order of like 100 microns, but we have to put them in a big, huge 9.7 Tesla magnet in order to do that. So this is clinically very useful to do 1 millimeter in plane. Here's what one of those very nice 1 millimeter isotropic voxel images looks like. And here's what we run for functional. These ones were taken in a pretty classic way up until a few years ago of doing it at 3.4 millimeters in plane resolution and a thickness of 5 millimeters. And so they're much larger voxels, but you get the benefit then of getting more signal in each of those voxels. So there's some benefit to that. I'll come back to this thing. This is not a normal looking brain. This person doesn't have a lesion here. So there's other problems with these images as well. But we run them at as high a resolution, sorry, as low a resolution as we can in order to increase the signal from those voxels. Lots of different ways to measure brain activity. You've probably talked about some of these. ERP, obviously, right? Most of your whole class is about that. MEG, we're not going to talk about today. John, are you talking about MEG in your classes? Okay, but you will?
Maybe a little.
It's actually sort of related, somewhere in between, actually, fMRI and EEG or ERP. It's using magnetic field, the magnetic fields that are naturally created at the surface of the cortex because of the electrical signal in the that is changing in the neuronal fields. And by knowing kind of what we do in fMRI, it gives you an idea. You can think back about what you might, how you might use that to actually capture that magnetic field change. So it's sort of the inverse of what we're doing in fMRI in some ways. I'm going to talk about PET. It uses radioactive isotopes, and we label substances, naturally occurring substances in the brain like oxygen and glucose, and has some really interesting properties and uses. fMRI we'll talk about most. I'm not going to talk about these two, but they're becoming more and more important in our evaluations, particularly of disorders like Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's, et cetera, where we're measuring, we can actually use MRI now to measure the oxygen uptake and the metabolic rates in the brain, and perfusion within the tissue, and then diffusion, which is more complicated, but it's essentially looking at the directionality of the movement of water molecules in the brain, so it can give us a very subtle signal of early pathology or the presence of edema. So it's important in stroke and perhaps the early onset of pathology, like I'm interested in it because of Alzheimer's disease. So this is a useful kind of map to have here, and this goes all the way from patch clamp recording up to lesions, and it just gives you kind of a comparison across all of these techniques in how we get at brain function from 1 millimeter to, or sorry, 1 millisecond out to about a year, the effects of the changes in brain along a long time course, and how, what the actual sort of overall size of the functional field has to be. And so I don't think that there's actually any lesion that is 1 meter across in the brain. Maybe if you have a really big animal. But everything from patch clamp recording, which is very fast and very small on the order of one neuron, up to fMRI is someplace in between here. ERPs beat us in terms of temporal resolution, but not so much in terms of, I would argue, with this scale, maybe with ERPs. And the lesion studies with animals and humans are out here. So it's a nice way to compare across the various methods. Okay, so let's talk about MRI. There have been a number of Nobel Prizes that have been won over the years for the development of things that were important for MRI. The first one was in 1952. It wasn't called MRI yet. It was called nuclear magnetic resonance or spectroscopy. What was the basis of spectroscopy? And Edward Purcell and Felix Bloch actually did this at the same time, and this happened in two different continents at almost exactly the same time. What they did was they found a way to use magnetism and radio frequency waves to measure the substance in a container. So they weren't doing anything about where stuff was in space. They were just saying what is actually in the container. And they did it first with paraffin wax, and then later on Purcell did the same thing with water, which was very important. It seemed like it was just not a very important thing to do at the time, but many, many years later, 30 years later, people would come back and use that information about water to create the MR images that we're using today. So all they used were a couple of elements, a static magnetic field, a transmit coil, and a coil for detection. So let's look at how that actually worked. So the reason that this worked was because they knew something about the physics of these molecules. And what they knew about it so far was that there was what was called resonant frequency. And that is that a molecule actually has a property called spin. So it's not staying stable and sitting still in its environment, but it's actually turning like a top. And it turns at a particular given frequency based on the molecule itself. So every molecule has a different frequency called the Larmor frequency. You might run across that term in your reading. If you know that Larmor frequency, you can take a molecule and change it from a low energy state. You can essentially add energy to it to take it into a high energy state. So it will absorb the energy, and then when you turn off the energy source, it'll give it back off again, and it'll return to its resting state. And knowing that, you can actually then measure the amount of a particular molecule in a given location. So, turns out that atoms that have an uneven number of protons, like hydrogen, they act as little dipoles. They're like little magnets. And so if you put them into a magnetic field now, just like the iron filings that you line up with putting a magnet in front of it or beside it, they'll all line up along the lines of the magnetic field. These little dipoles will align. So if I put you into a magnet, all of your little dipoles in the brain, the different molecules that are acting as dipoles, will align with the long axis of that magnetic field. And the one that's going to do it most is hydrogen. For one simple reason, there's just a lot of hydrogen in the brain, so that's what's going to align. Now, it's not just going to be aligned, but it's going to be precessing at that Larmor frequency. So it's like a little top sitting there, and here's the B0, or the direction of the magnetic field, and they're going to be turning around and around. Now, what happens? If we know that Larmor frequency, we can, and the frequency is usually in the range of radio frequencies, okay, so very low frequency, actually. If we know that, what we can do is now we can just add an RF pulse. We can put in radio frequency at that particular precession speed, and it will be absorbed by the molecule. So now that little dipole is going to go into a high energy state, and it's going to precess further and further away from the axis of the B0 of the field of the magnet, right? So it's in higher energy state. Once I turn off that RF pulse, now it's going to give up that energy, and it's going to relax. That's the relaxation rate, back to its low energy state, and it's going to give off RF. So I have it sitting in a magnetic field. It's precessing around. I add an RF pulse. It goes into its high energy state. And now I have what's essentially the same as your radio sitting there, something that's going to pick up that RF signal when I turn it off, and it's going to measure the amount of RF that's given off. The amount of that signal is going to be exactly proportionate to the number of those atoms in your beaker or whatever you put them in. Make sense? That's the basis of all MR. Very simple. Just put the dipoles into a high energy state and then turn it off and see how much signal you get back. That was pretty easy to do, although they won a Nobel Prize for it, so I guess it wasn't that easy to do. But it was relatively easy to do to just say how much of this stuff was in their sample. The real trick comes when you want to say where is it in the sample, because we want to turn this into a picture of a three-dimensional volume, which is a lot more difficult to do. So here we turn off the RF pulse again, and it gives off going around down here, you turn it off, and it slowly kind of works its way back up to that, and as it does that, it's giving off energy, and you're collecting it with your RF coil, and you know how much of the substance is there. And that's called magnetic resonance, by the way. That's where that term comes from. It used to be called nuclear magnetic resonance. That's only because this signal is actually coming from the nucleus. It didn't have anything to do with, like, nuclear energy. And people were very concerned about using that term, and that using it for in the lab and for clinical uses would be scary to people, so they just dump the term. So they now just call it magnetic resonance. But NMR and MR, it's exactly the same thing. Okay, why hydrogen? As I mentioned before, there's lots of it in the brain, but there's also some other things that are important to us. One is that it differs in density across the different tissue types. So there's most of it, not surprisingly, in the CSF, which is a fluid. So there's lots of water content in there. There's less in the gray matter, and then there's much less of it, again, in the white matter, which is mostly fat because of the myelin there. So now we have differences in the distribution of this hydrogen atom. And so we can try use that to say, hopefully, what kind of tissue type we're in just because of the amount of that RF signal that's given off. A couple other things that will also change the qualities of the signals that we use, and this goes back to the stuff that I showed you earlier about T1 and T2 and the different ways that you can kind of highlight different aspects of the tissue to get different looking images. It's not only the case that the water is in different quantities, but it has different properties because it's bound differentially in the different tissue types. So if it's in membranes, it's of the CSF, or in the membranes within the neuron, for example, it has different binding properties than if it's bound in the membranes that are making up myelin, for example. It's much more tightly bound, and so the relaxation rates are going to change a lot depending on how it's bound in the brain. So both of these things are really going to give us their properties that we can capitalize on to change our images in various ways. This is such a great image. So this the first cross-sectional image of the human body, not a brain. I showed you that one later on, but this is one of the human body, 1977. The brain, remember, was 1980, so just a few years later. A guy by the name of Demadian, and what he did was he created, you can see this is a big coil here. Looks sort of like the guts of what our MRI looks like right now, a magnetic coil. And then he had a smaller coil that he had. This is what graduate students had to do in those days to get their PhDs. This is a graduate student. And he's sitting this, and I think he was in there for something, does anybody remember? I think it was 12 hours to do this, to get these images. But what he did in order to get this image, it was, I think I have it here, how many? 106 voxels square here. But each voxel was collected as a single experiment, and then they moved him just a little tiny bit. So this thing took hours to collect for one image. But it was an interesting sort of first idea. We've ditched some of the things that are going on here, particularly one where you're moving people through in order to get the image. But how many of you have had a CT scan? Yeah, so we still move the CT galley. It moves back and forth in order to get the images. You don't have to move around in order to get each 2x2 image, but you do move through to, so we still use that technology to create CT images, but we've found other clever ways to do it. But this is a pretty interesting image. Then later on, Paul Lauterbur and Peter Mansfield did some interesting things where he took this basic stuff about how you could measure the hydrogen atoms in various tissues and capitalize on the differences in the properties of the tissues. And what they really worked out, two things. Lauterbur worked out the geometry of how you actually create an image, a two-dimensional image, without moving somebody around. And it's too complicated, we're not going to get into it here. But it was a great step forward because it meant that you could simply put someone in the scanner, leave them there, and by just switching a set of small magnetic fields around them, gradient fields, you could actually could have kind of sensitized the signal so that you not only measured how much you got from each region of the container, the head in this case, but where it was in the container as well. And then Peter Mansfield Something very important to us that it made us made it allowed us to do fMRI later on, he figured out how to get these images really, really fast. So with his echoplanar imaging methods, you went from taking about, in the early days, maybe about 3 minutes to get one section, one image of the brain, down to about 30 milliseconds to get that image. So it changed everything. We still do it at low resolution because it's not great signal, et cetera, but you can image now really, really fast. So we have in place all the little bits and pieces now to do functional imaging once we have that. I'll just mention back projection methods, which is what Lauterbur figured out. So remember that this is a sample. It's just a container, and it's got two beakers with some goop in it of some kind. Maybe water, maybe gel of some kind, and you're trying to get an image of it. And what Demedian did, remember, was he would just move it back and forth. That was the way that he did it. But what Lauterbur figured out was that he could make gradients or magnetic fields that were sort of ramped from higher field strength to lower field strength. And by just using not actually moving it physically, but by just changing the field, the directions of these ramps in the magnetic field, he could figure out where the change in the signal was in each one. And so you take an image essentially in this direction, you take one back here, you take one here, and you go all the way around, and then you just project them back on top of one another. And by simple averaging together, what you get is an image that shows you somewhat where the spot is that has the most of that diffusion or that change in the signal. Make sense? So that's really the basis of a two-dimensional image that we do in MRI. Okay, so MRI approved for clinical use in 1985. 3T came on the scene in 1996. It was a little bit later than that, actually, that the first fMRI experiment was done, and nobody's won the Nobel Prize for that, but I think they're holding their breath and hoping at some point. I think they might, actually, someday. But interesting little side story here is that Lauterbur and Mansfield were given the joint Nobel Prizes in 2003. Demedian, the guy who did the big images of the body, was excluded from the prize. And he was very, very incensed by this. In fact, he was so incensed that he took out major full-page ads in different journals and also in the New York Times to explain to the world why he was the one who had really created MRI. Who knows? I mean, it's an interesting story. It's difficult to know. There's lots of politics involved in that. But so some guys got it and some guys didn't for the development of these methods. Interesting story, though. Okay, components of a magnetic of an MRI. They're really pretty simple, and I'm just going to go through these ones quickly, because I know that you guys will be reading stuff in the future, or maybe you've already been reading that uses these terms, and it's useful to know what they're talking about. So we have two major components that we've already talked about. Well, three actually. The static magnetic field that we're going to put our sample in, which is us, a brain, a person. We have a transmit coil because we have to get that RF pulse in there in some way. And then we have to have a receiver coil. Now, actually, in our MRs, most of the transmit and receive coils are the same thing. They just turn on and off again. And so in one state, they're sending an RF signal, and in the other state, they're collecting the signal. But it's essentially the case that you have two kinds of coils there, a transmit and a receiver. And then you have to have these other things, which I'll mention briefly, tell you what they're for. So our first goal is that we have to create a really large and very homogeneous magnetic field. We want certain properties of this. It has to be a large enough magnetic field that you and your head can be in, and it's kind of stable across the head. That's a really large magnetic field. Magnetic fields drop off with a Gaussian distribution, So if they're very high in one very, very small point, and then they immediately drop off a lot. So you have to have a big magnetic field in order to get a homogeneous magnetic field that's large enough for our head to go into. We also want it to be stable over time. We don't want it to change over time. And so the way that we do this is we do it by using a superconducting magnet. So it's simply, it's just a solenoid. Let me see if I have, I do have, here's a solenoid. You just take a loop of wire, you wrap it, make many coils, and then you run a current through it. And whenever you do that, you're going to create, if the current is running in this direction through the coil, then it's going to create a magnetic field going in that direction through the middle of the coil. And that will be the sweet spot. And then it's going to drop off as it gets closer to the sides of the coil. Whoops. I didn't want to do that either. Okay. So this is the what I mentioned before. I called it B0, or the middle, the direction of the magnetic field. Now, this is exactly that simple thing, just having the coil and running a whole bunch of electricity through it, is the way that those big magnets work that pick up the cars. You know how they turn on a magnet, they bonk it down on the top, and it can lift a whole car. The problem with that is you have to use huge amounts of electrical current. And so you and I would not want to be around that thing and in the middle of it, for sure. And it would also be incredibly expensive, and you would have problems with heating, etc. So how do we keep the current running? Well, we cool this thing to as close to absolute zero as we can possibly get it. So now you all know from your high school physics or beyond that when you cool something to absolute zero, then the wire now has virtually no resistance. And so there's nothing that will slow down and dissipate the electrical current running through it, and so it will continue forever. That's pretty much the way it will go. There will be a tiny, tiny difference over many, many years, but it's going to be essentially remain the same. So you run, you cool this thing down, you run a current through it, very high current, and then you can turn the current off, and it will just keep running. And it has now you've created a stable magnetic field. So the field strength is important too. So the bigger that you make this coil, the lower the strength of the magnetic field is in here. So if you want to make it really, really strong, you make a really small coil. And so when we're talking about magnets that are 7 Tesla, 10 Tesla for animal imaging systems, the coil's really small, and so you can get some little animal in there like a mouse or a rat. But for us, we need to make them bigger, and so we have to use lower field strength to do that. Yeah?
So I have a question. If there's always this magnetic field, how come, like, you hear about these accidents or whatever, like when the thing gets turned on, like something gets sucked into the scanner? Like, if it's always magnetic, how come that happens, that there's not? How come that can happen?
The coil is always on, so the magnetic field is always on. It never gets turned off, and that's what is dangerous for people, because we're talking about huge field strength, 15,000 times the strength of the Earth's magnetic field. And so people don't realize that the magnet is on. They think it, the sound that you hear when it's banging, that's when you have the RF coils on. But the static field is always on, and so unfortunately it doesn't make any noise at that point. People don't realize that, and they'll go into the magnet room. I've seen a bucket fly in, a cleaning person came along with a bucket and one of those metal ones, and it's flown in. There's great images on different websites of office chairs, you know how they've always got the metal on the bottom, those things have flown into the magnet. And it will fly with a huge amount of force and very fast into the magnet. And in fact, it has killed a few people to have accidents like that. I wasn't going to get into this because I don't want to scare you to death, but but just so that now that we're on the topic, some of you know this story. The last one that we know of was several years ago. A little boy was having an MR scan. He had survived a brain tumor. He was having a year follow-up. and he was having an MR, and someone had an oxygen tank in the magnet room, and they had not checked to see that it was not ferromagnetic. And it, while he was in the scanner, it flew in, and it crushed his skull, and he died. So we take it really seriously.
So I guess that's what I was thinking. Like, so would someone had to have brought that in there while he was in the scanner, rather than like it had been in there before, and like how?
Yeah, that's a good question. Magnets are strange things that we really don't understand very well. You can have the same piece of equipment in the magnet room 20 times, and nothing will happen. And the 21st time or the 50th time, you'll have it in there, and it will just suddenly, you'll see it start to shake, and then it's gone. So it has to be just caught in exactly the right place in the magnetic field. It's not clear why it suddenly does it. You can imagine why it sort of happens with things like chairs, because they can roll. And so it starts rolling toward the magnet, and it flies in. But it's somewhat unpredictable. But mostly when we use equipment in there, we have to make sure that it's not ferromagnetic. So my assumption is that someone didn't check that particular oxygen tank. There are some that are safe for the MR environment and some that are not, and so they just didn't check. So I said at the beginning that MR is really safe. It is if you just kind of be careful and don't take certain things into the magnet room, because you can really get seriously injured. So we talked a little bit already about transmit coils and receiver coils. So the EM coil, the transmit coil, is going to create an oscillating frequency at the Larmor frequency, the resonant frequency, so that you can get these molecules into their high energy state. And then we're going to use the receive coil then to measure the energy that's emitted by the sample once you turn off the RF. And these are some of the ones that we use, and we don't use surface coils very much, but it's a coil that you can lay up against the brain. I'll show you what it looks like. It's really useful if you're just interested in one particular region of the brain. We use something that looks like this. It's called a birdcage coil, and so you have the large coil that you're laying in, but then you have another coil that's closer to the brain. We get it as close as possible to create a really homogeneous change in the frequencies around through the brain. And so this will act as both the emitter and the receiver.
So is that a surface coil? That's a like portable MRI, or does it still need to be attached to some big machine?
That's right. You just lay it. If you want to measure visual cortex, you lay it here. If you want to measure frontal cortex, you can lay it here, and it will create the change in the magnetic field here. And I think I have an image of that, actually. So this is a coil that's been laid across the back of the brain. You get a really high SNR in that region, but obviously you get nothing in the front of the brain, whereas here we're using a birdcage coil, and we do that because we want to get signal from the whole brain. Make sense? Yeah. You guys don't need to know how this works, right? For those of you aficionados out there, it's a Helmholtz pair. Here's our birdcage coil, and you just have two loops of wire, one here and one at the front, one at the back. You turn them on and they're oscillating, and so it's going to do the same thing as having a full coil all the way around, and it's going to create a magnetic field that goes through this way. Make sense? So that's how we do that. Yeah, this is why you have to have clever physicists around to figure out how to do that. We actually use something, you may see this term, and so I wanted to mention it. This is new and very cool. It gives us a huge increase in signal to noise in our scanners. We use what's called a phased array coil. We have an 8-channel coil. So instead of just having one of those surface coils, we now have an array around the brain that has 8 of those things, essentially. And they have some kind of geometry. These are 3 of them that are overlapping. And so you're essentially just taking those surface coils and wrapping them around the brain. And so you get all the benefits of the high field, the high signal from each of those ones. But there's problems because they're overlapping and stuff, and you have to figure out the geometry. But it gets so that what you still want it to do is give you a homogeneous image of the brain. But you get these things give us, with the 8-channel coils that we're using now, we get probably anywhere from a 3 to sevenfold increase in signal to noise. So we like these things. The newest ones coming down the pike are 32 channels. So they're going to be difficult to use, and they make headaches for everybody because of the amount of data that you collect. But just to mention what those are. Two other kinds of coils that we use. We use the gradient coils. These are these little coils that are laid sort of around the brain in different formations that where we create the gradients in the image or in the strength of the magnetic field that I mentioned before, that Paul Lauterbur figured out that you could use that information then to say where stuff is in the brain. And so when you go in the MR, you know how it's really loud and it's banging back and forth, making really loud noise? Those are the gradient coils switching on and off, because you have to turn the electricity on and off really fast. These are not superconducting coils. You get a magnet when you turn the electricity on, then you turn it off again. And so they're switching on and off really, really fast, and it's that physical switching of the electrical current that is causing all of the noise in there. So that's where it comes from. And then we have even smaller sets of coils in there. We call them shim coils. And we can use the complex software in the magnet to use these shim coils to kind of look at the homogeneity of the magnetic field across the brain and just sort of tweak it. So we use these little coils to just sort of say, well, we need a little bit more here and a little bit less here so that we get as close to a homogeneous field as we can so that we get a really nice, consistent image all the way through. So those are all the different coils that we use. And we do actually, before we start a scan with you guys who have been in there and done an experiment with us or for a clinical scan, we take a little short image at the very beginning and we look at the actual magnetic field. And then based on that, there's an iterative process where the scanner is resetting these shim coils so that it makes a really nice image. So when you first go in, some of you have been in there, you hear the clunk, 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 clunk. And it does that maybe 8-10 times before it starts to go brrrr to actually get the image. Those little clunk clunks are resetting the shim coils each time to get a better homogeneous field. You get really good at making noises. okay, so, and just a couple last things. The sampling rate. The temporal resolution is the amount of time that it takes us to create, to collect an image. And as I mentioned, we're getting really good at it now. We can get a whole brain within about 30 milliseconds. But when you decrease the sampling rate, that might actually be too fast for what you're doing. You don't have to do that. So we actually back it up. So we're taking, usually most places take about 2 seconds to collect maybe 30 images or so in the brain, each one 30 milliseconds to get each image. But you need a little bit of time in between for those gradients to go back to. There's all kinds of things about that, of why you need the time in between. But we can collect a whole brain image in around 2 seconds. You can do it faster, but that's what most people are using now. Couple of images to look at here. So this is an MRI of a normal 73-year-old female, and you can see that they're taken with three different sort of types of images that we've sensitized to different tissue properties. This is the proton density image. Not very great CSF to brain differentiation. We don't use this image all that much. The two that we use most often is this one and this one. These are relatively low resolution. This is a T1 where you can see the difference between the CSF and the brain really nicely, and some differentiation between gray and white there. And here, this is an obvious one where you can see all of the CSF. So if I just want to say how much atrophy does this woman have in her brain, this is the one that I would look at because it gives me really good differentiation of CSF to brain in that case. And we use these images to actually measure volumes of stuff. So this is a T1 weighted image. You can see the CSF in the middle here so that we can separate CSF from the rest of the brain. And we're doing in this project is we're just measuring the volumes of the hippocampus. And we have semi-automated methods of doing that. It's not trivial. But anyway, what we have found and other people have found is that if you measure this structure in older adults, it will give you some prediction of who is going to have memory impairment. It's not a big surprise, it's the hippocampus. But more importantly, who will go on to develop Alzheimer's disease, because this hippocampus actually doesn't change very much in the course of normal aging. It changes, we think, in the presence only of pathology associated with Alzheimer's disease. So that's one thing we can do with this stuff. This is just looking at across older adults. The relationship, you see three images here, a nice big plump hippocampi sort of in the middle, and then one that is significantly atrophied in this individual. And you can see just enough of the outside of the brain here to see that this atrophy isn't everywhere. It really is within this one region of the hippocampus, and so it's probably, well, we know it's affected very early in Alzheimer's disease. It's the first place we see the pathology, and so we can use our MRs to measure that, and it actually correlates pretty well with older adults' memory performance. I've used it for looking at white matter abnormalities. This is an image of a person with MS. But we've also, these are old strokes here that you can see, and you want to differentiate, you want to take this image in a different way to see a stroke than to see white matter abnormality. But we're very interested in this in older adults, because older adults have lots of white matter damage, but also early Alzheimer's has a lot of white matter abnormality as well. So we're using it for stuff like that. So any questions about the basics of MR? No?
Are you going to talk about
Do you want me to?
Well,
do you have a question?
How close are we to, or our researchers, to actually being able to use fMRI to make really good conjectures about whether a person is going to get Alzheimer's?
Far, far away.
Far away?
Yes. The problem is that by the time you have this kind of atrophy in the hippocampus that we could see on an MRI, this person has a significant amount of memory impairment and pathology associated with Alzheimer's, the plaques and tangles. So at this point, we use it as a kind of other piece of information just to tell us that the memory impairment in this person is not because they're having strokes or because there's something else or that there's a tumor, but that it's more consistent with Alzheimer's. But in terms of using them as the basis of diagnosis, we really can't do that. And so a lot of us are interested in finding better ways to do that using different MR methods. Like, for example, what I mentioned earlier, the diffusion-weighted imaging that might be sensitive to much earlier presence of pathology in those regions before you actually get that much tissue damage and tissue loss. But at this point, we can't do it.
But you can just look at that and say there's some sort, you can use it after death, and then you can go and you can look at the Lewy body.
Mm-hmm. No. We don't have, so the when you make an actual diagnosis of Alzheimer's, you have to put it's after death, it's at autopsy, and you have to actually take tissue samples and you put them under the microscope. So we can't see Lewy bodies, plaques, and tangles.
Right.
We can see the growth effect of those things and the neuronal cell death, but we can't use it for those kinds of things. Remember, our best resolution is 1 millimeter.
Right.
And so that's not going to get anywhere close to being small enough to see those plaques and tangles. It's a really good example of where MR to us looks so fantastic, but it's never going to have the kind of spatial resolution that will be useful for doing any kind of diagnosis based on the actual type of pathology that's there. Other questions about that? Okay. Where are we? Right. So let's talk about fMRI and what it is. What we're measuring essentially in fMRI in the signal is actually changes to the oxygenation of the tissue. It's as simple as that. It's really a perfusion measure. And understanding that will stop you from making a lot of bad inferences about your data or when you read a lot of papers out there, because it's very easy to slip into talking about the fMRI signal as if it's some direct measure of neuronal activity. And it's not. It's really far away from that, and we'll go through just how far away it is. The good things about it, it's relatively high resolution, nowhere near single-cell recording, obviously, but it's pretty good. It's much better than PET, and I would argue much better than ERPs as well. Pretty fast scanning time. It's tolerated well by individuals, and it's non-invasive. So the earliest attempts to do this kind of stuff were with PET, which required the injection of a radioactive isotope into an artery. So that's pretty invasive. It's also radioactive. So this doesn't have any of those problems. Non-invasive. We can put people into the scanner many times, and as far as we know, there's no long-term effects of this. If there is, I'm in trouble, because I've been in there hundreds and hundreds of times. There's some things to keep in mind that are not so good about fMRI. One of them is that it's very low signal-to-noise ratio. So when we're measuring the signal, even in the best regions of the brain, which tend to be things like the visual cortex and the motor cortex, we're looking at about a 2% signal change. But in my favorite place, the hippocampus, we are usually measuring 0.1% of signal change in that region. So it's a tiny, tiny change in the face of all that physiologic noise that's going on in the background. So we have very little sensitivity to that kind of signal change. It's very sensitive to motion. I'll come back to that. We'll talk about it a little bit. And also some other artifacts that you got a little inkling of when I showed you those very first images, the raw EPI images. So what is it? So the MR signal that we get from the brain is dependent on several things. It's dependent on the properties of the tissue, how much hydrogen there is in there, right, in the particular tissue type, how it's bound with the other molecules around it, whether it's in the myelin and it's tightly bound or whether it's freely moving in CSF. But it's also dependent on the field strength of the magnet. So as soon as I increase the field strength from 1.5 to 3 Tesla, it's going to significantly increase the amount of signal that I get from the brain. But it's also dependent on sort of local environmental issues, and that becomes very important for us to understand. And the one that we're interested in is what's described as a paramagnetic substance. So paramagnetic substances are molecules in the brain that are very strong dipoles. Okay, so they are going to act as little magnets in a particular region, and they're going to essentially disrupt the MR signal in that little local environment. And the one we're most concerned about here is deoxygenated hemoglobin. That's the stuff in the blood that when it's oxygenated, when there's oxygen attached to it, it's going to move oxygen through the vasculature to provide oxygen to the tissue. So deoxygenated hemoglobin is paramagnetic. So when it's sitting still and there's a bunch of it in the local tissue, it's actually going to decrease our signal because it's perturbing the magnetic field. It's just disrupting it slightly. So let's look through this and see how this works. So we start off, we're doing some kind of task in the scanner. Let's say it's just something simple. This one is finger tapping. So we're just pressing a button with our hand, one or the other hand, whenever something comes up on a screen. Okay. So in this region of the motor cortex, we expect that there's some local neuronal activity, right? Neurons are firing. What happens because those neurons start firing? They need oxygen, they need glucose because that's taking energy to increase their firing rate, so you get an increase in metabolic need. And that's local, very localized increase in this need. And the vasculature is amazing. It knows exactly where this increase in metabolic need is, and so it will start to shunt things like oxygen and glucose to that particular region. So we get an increase in blood flow that is very localized to the neuronal activity. And then you get increased oxygenated hemoglobin going to the region because that's what it needs. It needs oxygen. And then this step is interesting, and it's very important here. It turns out it's kind of like it's as if the vasculature doesn't know how much oxygen that little blob of tissue is going to need. So it sends more than it could possibly need, and it keeps sending it to the region. So it's sending more oxygenated hemoglobin. The oxygen is being taken up by the neurons, but there's always this surplus left over in the region for a small amount of time until those neurons stop working again. So you get uptake of oxygen that's less than the supply of oxygenated hemoglobin, and so you get a surplus there. So now we've increased the oxygenated hemoglobin. That means locally we've decreased deoxygenated hemoglobin, which was paramagnetic, and so now what we get is a slight increase in the MR signal in that particular local region. Does that make sense? Okay, a lot of steps. So we go from neuronal activity up here through many, many steps here to get down to this last part, which is this local increase in the MR signal that lasts several seconds or so. So it's very important to keep in mind when you're reading fMRI papers that you are so very far away from neuronal activity. And this stuff is going to depend on lots of things. The vasculature. If you're working with older adults don't have the same kind of perfusion in the brain that young people do, so that's going to change the signal. If there's damage in a region, that's going to change the signal because you're not going to be able to get this oxygenated hemoglobin there. If someone is doesn't have high levels of oxygen, they have problems with blood pressure or just perfusion in general, that's going to change things as well. If they've had caffeine in the last hour or so, that will change the amount of oxygenated hemoglobin that can get to the tissue. So all of these kinds of things are going to make individual differences in the fMR signal that has nothing to do with neuronal activity. You have to keep in mind what that signal is that you're measuring. So here's how it works. Yeah?
So that chain of events, you detail clearly how that could differ between people, but is there any evidence that there might be at least some consistency within a person across brain regions, or could that same problem apply that, you know, some regions of the brain become more active and their change in metabolic need is greater per unit of activity and the blood flow changes differ?
Right. That's a really good question. So we know that when you look at the exact same region in an individual over days, that there's a pretty good correspondence. It's a really nice consistency in the signal. There is less consistency when you look across individuals in a given region, but there's also much less consistency when you look across the brain. So the fMR signal, the hemodynamic response, this is called the hemodynamic response, this change in the signal. It might be very different in the visual cortex than it is in the frontal lobe. We haven't done enough to really understand why that is, because it could be because of differences in perfusion and the vasculature for different reasons, but it also could be because the brain works differently in different regions. So you could imagine that visual cortex will give you a very fast signal that then stops. That's sort of what it looks like. Whereas the frontal lobe, what we tend to see are changes in signal that are a little slower to come on, and then they last much longer and they drop off. And that could be because we don't turn our frontal lobes on and off in the same way. So we're not sure of what the basis of those differences are across the regions. Any other questions about that?
Maybe just a quick follow-up. Yeah. This might be jumping the gun. So we don't really have any way to take that into account statistically. We can somehow correct for multiple comparisons, but that just kind of assumes that there's a uniformity to the extent to which there might be changes in the signal.
That's absolutely true. And most, if I get there, I'll talk about, you know, how we do these analyses. And we tend to do the analysis in every region of the brain separately. But now a lot of us are interested in doing these multivariate analyses where we're looking at patterns of activation across the brain. And just because we don't see any correspondence between posterior regions and frontal regions doesn't mean that they're not working together. It could be really because there's significant differences in these the kind of the rise time and the stability of the HDR in those different regions. It's a very good point. We worry about it more when we're looking across groups. So there's lots of studies out there now that look at fMRI signal and compare it, good old hippocampus, here we are back there again, between, like, for example, young people when they're doing memory tasks and older adults, or they'll do it between older adults and people with Alzheimer's disease or early Alzheimer's and mild cognitive impairment. But remember those images of the older adults with hippocampal atrophy that are associated with Alzheimer's. So you've got tissue damage in that region, you've got changes in the vasculature and in perfusion in the tissue across those groups, and so people are making big statements about what the differences are in hippocampal function across those groups, and they're not taking into consideration the possibility that there are lots of things that are going to change this part, and it has nothing to do with differences in the neuronal activity. So it's a very important thing to keep in mind. Any other questions? Okay. So all of our fMRI experiments are subtractions of some kind. It's subtracting, it's comparing one state to the other. So you always have to at least have two sets of images to compare. One of them is something like a resting state, although we're going to turn this probably in an experiment into some kind of control condition, where we're going to measure the signal in this region of tissue, and this is a kind of a caricature of the vasculature moving through this tissue, and here's the tissue here, it would be the capillary bed there where the oxygen is going to be taken up. And in the resting state, what you have is a bunch of oxygenated hemoglobin coming in, and the vast majority of it is being taken up by the tissue. So there's not a lot left. So on the venous side, you have a lot of deoxygenated hemoglobin. So the signal is going to be sucked out on this side, right, more than over here, because this is our paramagnetic substance, right? Now we have some stimulated state where the neurons in this region here are working hard. We have an infusion of more of this oxygenated hemoglobin. Some of it is being taken up, but we have this overflow. We have more of it there than we need. And so on the venous side now, you're going to see more of the oxygenated hemoglobin. So the ratio of that oxygenated to deoxygenated is going to change. There's fewer of the little blue things, and so the signal here is going to go up. So you essentially subtract this one from that one, and you see where the signal difference is, and that gives you an idea of where the deactivation is actually happening in the brain. Oh, did I die? This one? This one. No, it's still on. That's okay. Isn't technology wonderful? Yeah, why don't we take a break and we can come back in, I don't know, how long do you guys take? 15 minutes? Okay. Yeah, sure. I'll remember exactly where I am. Control 3. Okay.
I only kind of think about some Frankenstein experiments where you're recording with, you know, intracranially in people in the magnet watching signal change, but of course you wouldn't put those electrodes in people who are healthy in the first place, where you could see neuronal activity. There was
one, that's why people want, you know, are really so... Should I turn this on, please?
Talk confidential stuff.
Wow! 13 seconds to blast off.
Your audio will be on the web tonight, and your video will be on the web tonight.
I don't want to see it.
I just
want to
warn you, because you turned the lights off, I mean, it's great.
That's good. That's good.
Usually, actually, both work out fine with the lights on.
I won't be offended in the least. It's okay. Yeah. Oh, okay. So are we ready? Yeah? Okay. So remember this? And we had our resting state and our stimulated state, and we're going to look at the differences between the two. So if you translate this, just to finish off this story real quick, if you translate this into an experiment, we're going to have the subject doing something usually in the scanner. That's our control condition. It might be just staring at a fixation point. It might be actually pressing a button and making some simple judgment of left or right as an X and an O comes up. And then we're going to scan them during some kind of task, and we're going to look at where in the brain these signal changes occur. It's always a difficulty because this is our signal. It's a very small signal, as I mentioned, in some regions, and we're going to have to assess that kind of using some kind of statistics to deal with all of the physiologic noise that's going to happen between those two states as well. So this is a difficult thing to do, but keep in mind that every experiment that you see in the literature and that you read about, it's equally important that you pay very close attention to what this rest condition was, what the control condition was. Because if they picked the wrong one or just a different one, it may determine whether or not you get activation in a particular region. So if I take two tasks that both activate the hippocampus, maybe for very different reasons. One of them has some kind of spatial component that I didn't think about, and one has a memory component. I'm going to actually shoot myself in the foot. I'm not going to be able to see activation in that region. So whether or not you get signal is always going to be determined by what that tissue is doing during the control condition. And sometimes you can be extremely surprised by that. Okay, so when we look at that's a statistical map, obviously. So a couple of caveats that probably are pretty obvious by now. First of all, we're way far away from neuronal activity when we're measuring this stuff. This is what we refer to as the hemodynamic response, the change in the signal based on these changes in the vascular response. Really, really small, subtle changes in signal, at most 1 to 2%. And the other thing to keep in mind, that remember on this image, where is the biggest signal change going to be? Is it over here on the arterial side of things? Is it at the actual capillary bed, or is it on the venous side? It's on the venous side. So in fact, the signal, the biggest change in the signal that you get can be around the big draining veins, and it can be actually quite far away from where the neuronal activity was. So you have to be careful so that you know where these big draining veins are, because you're going to get big changes in the signal. For example, here we almost always get some big blobs of activation in these posterior regions that are actually outside of the brain. And that's because we have the draining sinuses. So we often get, there isn't one in this image, we're not quite low enough, but you'll get a big blob of activation there. That's not the brain, it's a draining sinus. So it can be relatively far away from the actual gray matter that is activated during that task. It's extremely sensitive to motion, and the hemodynamic response has an interesting property. It's very slow. So let's look at a couple of those things here. Let's look at the hemodynamic response, first of all. So this is a brain where we've just measured finger tapping. Okay, they see an X, and literally hundreds of times, we might have done this 1,000 times with these poor subjects, we had them just press a button every time an X came up with one finger. And I've actually plotted the same experiment with the right and the left. It doesn't matter which one it is. But the finger tap occurred right here at the zero point. So I've lined up all of these signal changes. And this is taken from one of the voxels right here in the middle of this motor cortex region. And what you see is that this axis we have seconds. So one finger tap that takes 70 milliseconds, something like that, to perform. And what we get is a signal change that actually takes 4 seconds to peak. It doesn't really change much at all in the first 2 seconds. And then it changes a lot more over the next 2 seconds. And then it drops off, and it actually takes quite a lot of time to come back down. And then it does this funny thing that is interesting to people who are trying to figure out what the vasculature is doing. It actually has an undershoot. So for a few seconds, the signal is going to, in fact, drop down below the resting baseline level before it sort of starts to come back and wander around the zero point again. So this whole thing, from the onset of the stimulus to the time that it returns to baseline, is about 12 seconds. So now if we want to do experiments where I show you hundreds of items, I'm either going to have to wait a very, very long time in between each stimulus that I show you so that I can see this rise time and get back to baseline, or I'm going to have to do some tricky things here, and that's where we get into using event-related designs, which I'll tell you about. But this, very important to keep in mind that it's not an immediate response. It's a very slow response. Yeah.
I don't know if you're going to talk about this later, but I know like fMRI studies usually use right-handed people. Can you talk a little bit about why that's the case?
I have never figured that out. I don't. I mean, unless you're doing language studies where you see a lot of lateralization, as far as we've seen in our hippocampal studies, we've actually looked at left-handers versus right-handers, and we don't see a lot of differences in the brain. But that's why, because you know, you might be sort of, if you're averaging across individuals, and some people are showing most of the activation on the left if you're doing a language task, and the others on the right. Or it's bilateral in some individuals, it's more difficult to figure out what's going on. Left-handers generally don't show you just a complete switch to the other hemisphere, but they'll show you more bilateral activation compared to right-handers. It's a good question, though. I want to mention, I already mentioned, actually, that we do these at a lower resolution so that we get enough signal from the voxel. That's because we're looking for these really, really small changes. Susceptibility is a problem too. So we take these images very quickly. That took about 30 milliseconds to collect this image. But you'll notice that there's kind of like these big bites out of the side of the brain. This is the same section as this one. So there should be cortex here in the lateral temporal lobe. There should be a hippocampus, and there isn't one here. And also in the frontal lobe here, it's like there's little nibbles outside of the edge of the brain around where this brain is full here and it's gone here. And wherever you get these transitions in the density of the tissue, and the biggest ones for the brain are going to be between the regions that are air and tissue, so around the sinuses, you're going to get this loss of signal. See the sinuses there? That's an air space. And so you start losing tissue around here. It's called a susceptibility artifact. We lose it here for the same reason. The sinuses are sitting just below this region. The orbital frontal cortex, very hard to image because the big sinuses are sitting right underneath it. And what's responsible for this big bite out of it? Anybody think of it? The ear canals. They're going straight in here, and so you've got air, an air pocket, all the way in here, and so you're losing signal there. Yeah.
It's not like an evil scientist question, but could you fill their sinuses with fluid?
It is the evil scientist question, yes. But people have tried to do things somewhat like that. So there are various methods. I haven't seen anybody try to do it here, but certainly in the mouth, what people have tried to do is put something in their mouth, so an actual piece of material that would lay up against the top of the mouth and would decrease the susceptibility. Other people have tried it with putting a type of gas into the sinuses. It's very hard to control, but you can do it with animals. You just try and find people who have really, really bad colds to be your subject. And that will help you. But this is very problematic for those of us who are interested in the hippocampus or people who are interested in orbital frontal cortex if you're doing problem solving or reward kinds of systems. This is really difficult. And the fact that you never get any signal from the lateral temporal lobe in fMRI should tell you something very important when you're looking at those nice charts that people have of what regions of brain are activated during various kinds of language tasks. The fact is we just don't get any signal from those regions. There's tricky things that you can do actually now to decrease the susceptibility, at least here. Not so much on the lateral temporal surface, but orbital frontal and medial temporal surface that we can get back some of that signal. But it's technically difficult to do. So you want to keep that in mind as well. So how do we do these very simple experiments? So let's take an example. We just do word identification. We just want people to read words. We show them to them visually, and we want them to read, and we want to see what regions of the brain are activated. Simplest one that we can do is called a block design, where we show them a group of words for a while, maybe 20 seconds. In this one I've got, 20 seconds. So in this one, they see a bunch of words, and they make a decision for each one, whether it's a word or non-word, and they press a button. So this is a lexical decision. And then 20 seconds, this is our control task. We don't want to show them words, because that would get rid of, we're going to subtract away that this condition, so we don't want them to be words. So I might show them something like X's and O's, and they just have to press the button left and right. Now what does that do? It should subtract our left-right button presses, so I should no longer see motor cortex, because they're doing it for both conditions. But what I should see, this is so hard to do this little thing, what I should see is something that gives me the region where they're assessing wordness of the material as opposed to just seeing X's and O's. So for 20 seconds I have word, I start off with a rest or the X's and O's, words, X's and O's, words, X's and O's, and now I'm just going to do some kind of statistic between them. So the easiest thing that I could do is I could just bin these, all the signal here and here together, and the ones down here, and I could just make an average and do a t-test, and that would be the end of it, right? I would just be subtracting one from the other. And that would be the simplest thing, and that's what we started off doing years ago when we did this stuff. It works pretty well. Remember your statistics. If you do a t-test, that's the same as a correlation with a function of zeros and ones. So it's the same as doing an R, doing a Pearson R, where the zeros are here. Where the zeros are here and the ones are here, right? Zeros and ones. Now, I can make a better fit to the model because I know, remember, my hemodynamic response sort of takes some time to go up and it can go back down again. So what I can say is, well, it's not going to be a perfect, when this changes, it's not going to go up immediately and it's not going to go off immediately. So I can convolve what I know about the hemodynamic response with these zeros and ones. And what I'll get is a function that looks something more similar to this. Make sense? So now this is the estimate of the signal change that I should see in any voxel that is associated with reading a word. And now I'll do a correlation, a Pearson correlation at each voxel, and get something that's closer. And that's basically what we do. There's some tricky things as well. There's a big assumption here that you have to keep in mind, and that is that we do our statistics of a correlation, for example, at every single voxel in the brain. And if we do that, we're assuming then independence across the voxels. So that means that if I do a correlation here, that it would be independent of one correlation that I get back here. That's not a bad assumption, but what about doing getting an R value here and in the voxel that's immediately adjacent to it? Well, that's a really bad assumption in the brain. First of all, we know that the brain has functional fields where regions of brain work together. So this one might be the same functional field as this one, so they're going to co-vary. But it also, remember where our signal is coming from, it's dependent on the vasculature. And so the same vein or artery that perfuses this voxel is probably going to have some perfusing effect on the voxel beside it. So independence is a really bad assumption here. So we can think about functional fields and the distribution of the vessels we have to think about as well. But the fact is we have many, many multiple comparisons to do, and how do we deal with this? And in fact, if you think about it, if you have a brain that is even in our kind of low resolution, we have an image that's 64 by 64. Somebody can do the math. And then you multiply that by 30 sections of the brain, and you're getting up somewhere around 100,000 statistical tests that you're doing just to do those tests at every single voxel in the brain. So that's a huge number of statistics that you should get that are significant just by chance alone. Different ways of dealing with this that we won't go into a lot. One of them is that you can, in SPM, you can actually impose a structure. So we don't know what the structure is, the covariant structure in the brain. So one statistical method for doing this is we impose a structure. So we say that there's some moderate amount of covariance across the brain. It's going to be greater for voxels that are contiguous than voxels that are further away. It's not the true world, but it's making our statistics more conservative, and we want to do that. So it's a pretty good, it's a compromise. It's a good way to go. It's better than just doing nothing at all. The other one is clustering. And so if we look back at, I don't know what I have next here. Right. So if we have 2,048 voxels in this one image, by chance alone, 102 of them will be statistically significant, right, at p.05, 5%, right? So, but that means that they should be randomly distributed throughout all of the voxels that we, all of the tests that we've done. What happens, though, if they're all bunching together? So, by chance alone, this should happen much less often. And what we can do is we can actually calculate what the decrease in probability is for two of these little guys happening contiguous to one another, and how much less likely it is that three or four or five of them cluster together. So in this brain, you might want to disregard the single voxels and say, I'm not sure about those. They might be by chance alone. But I know now that this cluster is much less likely to happen by chance alone, and so I'm going to say that's a significant difference, and I can actually calculate that that difference in the p-value, and so that's a very important way that we say that we give some confidence to what we do. Another approach is to, let's say I'm interested in lateral temporal lobe, since that's about where this blob is, or maybe it's in the motor cortex if it's up high. And maybe I don't care about the rest of the brain. So instead of doing all these thousands of tests, what I can say is I want to go and I'm interested in Broca's area. So I'm just going to, and I know where that is in the brain, I'm going to identify it anatomically. I'm going to do a region of interest analysis. And the only place that I'm going to do my statistics is in Broca's area. So I just go and I do my statistics here, or maybe even further over on the edge of the brain. And I've decreased immensely the number of actual statistical tests that I use. This approach is becoming more and more popular. Now that people have done a lot of experiments and they sort of see generally where stuff is activated in the brain, it's not as important for people to see the whole brain, although I still get reviewers coming back and saying, why are you only showing us what happens in the hippocampus? What about the rest of the brain? And I want to say, what rest of the brain? Who cares about the rest of the brain? Anyway, so that's a very powerful way to increase or decrease this multiple comparisons problem in the brain. I'm going to skip over that because this is complicated. But if anybody's interested in this is a big assumption in doing these kind of subtractions, and that is the simple version of this is that if you do task A by itself, the brain works one way. If you do task B by itself, the brain works another way. But if you're doing A and B together, it's not necessarily the case that the brain works by going back and forth from A to B. There may be some interaction that the brain has to do something, like, for example, switching from task to task, or monitoring across multiple tasks, or keeping multiple rules in mind from task to task. So our basic assumption of this subtraction may be a really bad one. And if you're interested in this stuff, you should read more on that because it's a very important thing to consider when you're looking at when you're looking at brain function. So event-related, this is becoming more and more kind of the thing to do. Whether it's the right thing to do or not is another question, but in a lot of cases, we want to make our experiments much more like real experiments that we would do in the lab, as opposed to showing somebody a task for a 20-second period and then switching to another task. We want to show them individual stimuli. For example, in word identification, or if you're doing lexical decision, it really matters what the qualities of the words are, whether they're high-frequency words or low-frequency words, what the stimuli are that you're comparing it to, the errors that people make. And if you're doing block design, you can't take that into consideration. You just have a big bunch of the words, and you're averaging the signal across all of those stimuli. So if somebody makes a bunch of errors in there, I can't do anything about it. All I can do is sort of say, well, the majority of the words in there they were right about, so I'll just hope that I get enough signal from that that it averages out and overrides the errors. So when we do the event-related designs, this is much better for us in many ways because now we can take into consideration the exact response of the subject to every single stimulus. So remember, it took us 12 seconds to get through a hemodynamic response. So the simplest experiment would be just present one thing, get a response, wait 12 to 14 seconds, present another thing, wait another 12 to 14 seconds. This would take us forever in the scanner to do an experiment. Sometimes it actually works. Sometimes you only need like 10 or 12 of these things to get a really nice estimate of the HDR. But in a lot of cases, we need a lot more stimuli. And so what we'll do is fast presentations where we're taking two or three, maybe even four different kinds of stimuli. And what we're doing is we're randomizing them. So here I have a presentation where here's the at the beginning of each of these is another item. So I'm going to randomly distribute these through here. And I've got this kind of stimulus. Let's say this is the word. And so it starts here, and you expect a hemodynamic response. Here's another one that comes on maybe 2 or 3 seconds later. You expect another one. Then I wait 5 or 6 seconds, and I show another one. And maybe I'll wait a longer time before I come back to that condition, and I show them another one here. It's 14 seconds later, and so on. And you can see how this works. Now I know what my estimate of the hemodynamic response is for each of those stimuli. So all I do is I convolve them together. I just add them up. And so what my estimate of the signal is will go, I didn't do a great job of drawing this, but you get the idea, that two of these together are going to be additive, and so you're going to get a signal that looks something like this. So now I can say for words, I'm going to look for a correlation across my voxels that looks something like this. For the control condition, I'm going to look for something else. For a different kind of stimulus, I'm going to look for something else. This has turned out to be very useful in and very sensitive to small, subtle differences in regions that are activated during various kinds of tasks. I've used it for things like looking at, for example, word frequency differences in the brain. Or we can look at remembering one kind of stimuli versus another. Language has been used in a lot, visual stimulation as well, of different, even just showing, you can actually show stimuli that have different orientations. And if you use enough of them, you can actually see where in primary visual cortex you get activation for items that have an orientation in this direction versus this. So if you have enough of these stimuli, you can do a really good job, and that's very useful. The downside to this, however, everybody's using it, but there's a big price to pay, and that is power. So in order to do an experiment like I shouldn't have bothered going back. Never mind. The block design, where it was just a square up and down, I might be able to see the same regions of activation for doing word, non-word responses in an experiment that takes about 2 minutes in the scanner. And here, I'm going to have literally hundreds, if not 1,000, of these words to really get a good estimate of the signal for each voxel. And so it takes me way longer. It takes many, many more of those stimuli. The other problem with this is that this thing, me making this estimate, this model, means that I was right when I said that this is what's going to happen when there's a stimulus onset. So if my model of the HDR is incorrect, then I'm screwed. I'm not going to be able to find any activation in regions. And as John said, it's a very bad assumption that this looks exactly the same for every single voxel in the brain. So you lose an enormous amount of sensitivity using this kind of experiment. You can underestimate response in the brain because you've got the wrong HDR model. But the good side is that you can do much more sophisticated experiments and look at single responses to a particular kind of stimulus. But event-related is not the be-all and end-all. It's not the way to go in every situation, even though most reviewers will tell you it is right now the way to go. Okay, we just talked about these things as well. I want to take just a couple minutes at the end to talk. Any questions about fMRIs before you go on? Yeah. Can you say the bit at the beginning again? I didn't hear you. The wrong HDR. It's a really good question. So I mentioned the block design has power for other reasons, but that is also one of them, that if you do the kind of modeling and when you have that, you know, we started off with a square wave and then we convolved it with something that looks like an HDR, you can make really quite large changes in what that HDR looks like. And if you have about 10 or 15 seconds of them, it'll end up looking exactly the same. So it's much less sensitive to being that your model is correct. And so you don't have to worry about it as much. So that's a really major reason why you have an increased power when you're doing these block designs. It's insensitive to you being incorrect about the shape of the hemodynamic response. It's a good point.
Related to that, in your drawing, it looks like you just assumed that they were additive.
Oh, that's a really good point, too.
You could have added cases where it couldn't keep going.
Right. And we do know that that's true, that if you have many of these together, very close together, at some point there's asymptotes, and so they're not simply additive. The experiments have been done in some regions. Again, all of these experiments are done in the visual cortex and motor cortex because they're so easy to do these really fast stimuli. We know in those regions that if you put two together, it is generally a good assumption that it's additive. When you have three, it starts to not quite make it. And when you have four, then it starts to not make it as far up. But as long as you have the general shape, I mean, correlations are more sensitive to general shape, the ups and downs, than they are to the amplitude. So as long as you have, you don't kind of keep bunching these together too much so that you come up with these highs and lows that are going up and down, that's where you get all of your power from. And so we don't worry too much about the amplitude issues in that case or the additivity, but it's true that when you're doing these event-related designs, you don't want to have runs of three or four, well, three is okay, but you wouldn't want to have four or five or six of the same items together because you get no benefit from that. And in fact, the more you do that, the more it is that your model is going to be incorrect. So you want to kind of bop back and forth from being on and off at various stages. Any other questions? Okay. So I wanted to talk a little bit about PET. As I mentioned earlier, you know, we don't do a lot of PET here. It was used in the early days. In fact, the first functional studies that I did were PET studies, not fMRI. That's because it wasn't invented yet. And so it's fallen out of favor for a number of reasons, but it's still being used, and it's actually having a little bit of a comeback for other uses. And so I want to talk about it a little bit, and it's certainly still out there in the literature. So here we're actually measuring brain metabolism, the actual utilization of something like oxygen or glucose. Those are the two major ones. And we're using a radioactive tracer to see where that activation is. And just to go back to something that compares the two, so here's MRI. We're down in the non-ionizing radiation level of radio frequency waves. There's ultrasound. And then at some point you get up into, here's photons up there. This is not working anymore. But here's ionizing radiation. And here's X-ray and CT, which we already know is pretty high, right? There's definite limits on how much X-ray you should have in your lifetime, because we know if you have too much of this stuff, it causes cancer. And here's PET. So it's really high radiation levels, ionizing radiations. It's in the gamma ray spectrum. Generally, people can have a PET scan once every 2 years. It used to be that you could only have one in a lifetime. It's changed a little bit because they've been able to do PET scanning now with lower levels of radiation, but it still is a much more invasive method than using ultrasound or MRI, which you could have every day of the week if you felt so inclined. We use a cyclotron, a really big cyclotron, to create a radioactive isotope, where what we're doing is we're essentially forcing extra protons to be added into the nucleus. And this causes an instability in the nucleus of the molecule that we're interested in measuring. So then we take that radioactive isotope and we glue it to a molecule that we're interested in, usually oxygen or glucose. And then what we do is we allow it to be taken up by the individual. It goes up into the brain, and then it starts to decay. And we can actually watch that decay as it happens in the brain. So let's look at this. So first of all, if you're doing PET, you think that all the gear that you need for MRI is complicated. You need even more if you're doing PET, because you have to have a massive cyclotron. This is as big as or bigger than one of our MRI machines, to just give you some idea of how big this thing is. This thing sits about 12 feet tall off the ground. And so this is the cyclotron where we're going to make the radioactive isotope, where we're going to force those extra protons into the molecule. And then it has to have a whole chemistry lab connected to it as well, where very clever chemists are going to bind that radioactive isotope to the molecule of interest. And then these things have decay, very short-lived decay times. So in the few minutes, perhaps, that thing is going to stay connected, we have to get it from the cyclotron into the PET scanner. It kind of looks like a big size MRI. Inject it into the individual and give it enough time to be taken up into the brain while they're doing the cognitive task. So this is a nightmare to make this actually work before you can ever get any images from it. So how does this annihilation work? It's kind of interesting. So here's our bound molecule. We have some extra positrons. Sorry, we have positrons here. And so it's going to begin to decay because it's unstable. It's been taken up in the brain. And so this positron is going to go floating off. It's just going to leave its binding. And it's going to move in some random fashion away from the nucleus until it bangs into an electron. And when it bangs into that electron, they're being attracted to one another, you have an annihilation event. And at that point, what you get is a gamma ray that's being given off. And a gamma ray is two photons, and these two photons are emitted in exactly opposite direction from the annihilation event. Okay? So two photons are created, and they have the same energy, and so they're going to move at the same speed in exactly the opposite direction away from the annihilation event. So So you get these moving away in a 180 degree path, and it actually happens with sufficient energy that those photons will move outside of the brain. So it's not going to be particularly attenuated. They're very high energy, and it's not going to be attenuated by the bone. It is to some extent, but the simplest model for this is there's no attenuation out of the brain. And so we can put a ray of detectors outside the brain. You get uptake, watch these little annihilation events, and we can actually detect these events as they're happening in the brain. This is important, too, that there's some scatter. So no matter how good our PET scans are, we're never going to get resolution better than 2 millimeters, or actually 2 millimeters cubed, right, because it's in every two scatters in 2 millimeters on average around before you get an annihilation event. So it's going to have, here's the event, here's the actual molecule, the nucleus, and here's the event, and there's always on average about a 2 millimeter scatter in every direction away from the original nucleus. But what we want to measure is what's called the line of response. And so what we want to say is a couple of things. Did an event happen? Was there an annihilation event? Then we want to say, where was it in the brain? And we have to, in order to do this, what we have to determine is what's called coincident determination. And this is actually a really difficult thing to do. So we'll look at an example of how this works. So let's say we have an array of detectors on either side here, okay? And here's our little nucleus. And we have some, well, it's a little bit further away, and then it scatters away 2 millimeters or so, bangs into an electron, annihilates, and we get a gamma ray here, and we have two photons. So these are our photon detectors on either side. And if this happened right smack in the middle, it would move equally in this direction and this direction. So we could say that when we find an event that happens at exactly the same time here as here, we can make the assumption that the event happened exactly halfway in between. Right? Follow me? But what happens if this event actually didn't happen here, but we've got this big round head in here, so it happened over here? So now the probability that it hits here and here at the same time and is considered a coincident event is going to be much lower. And so this is actually a very difficult thing to figure out how to measure these coincident events. Oh, I forgot about it, then we're going to go on to this thing. Okay, so what we have, we put the person in the scanner, and we have an array around the outside of the head of scintillating detectors that are going to detect the presence of these photons. What we're essentially going to count is every time that something hits one of these detectors at almost the identical time that it takes for it to hit the detector that is 180 degrees away from it. And so the first thing you realize right away is we're going to throw away massive numbers of actual events because they're going to be lost here because we're not going to see them happening at exactly the same time. So it's going to be dependent on things. The quality of the image that we're going to get is dependent on lots of things. How many of these events actually happen, right? We need lots and lots of them because we're going to lose lots and lots. How small these detectors are and how sensitive they are. And also a lot of it is the math that you apply to figure out where these events, whether an event actually occurred and where it is. It's extremely complicated mathematical modeling that goes into creating these images. These are tomographic projections, just like the original images that we showed you in MRI where you moved it around and you take all of these images and sort of put them together. So if I have this one, if I keep having incident events here and I find these two incident, these detectors being activated at the same time, I just make a straight line through. And sooner or later you can see already that I'm starting to get crosses in the lines that are aligning with the edge of the head and some on the inside of the head. And so over time, I'm going to throw away the ones that are lower probability of happening, and I'm going to build up an array in here that shows me where these events are occurring. But I'm going to lose a lot of data. So this is an unbelievably insensitive way of measuring radiation in being given off by the brain. Talked about some of these things already. The spatial resolution is always going to be bounded here by that scatter. There's nothing we can ever do with this. So right away, MR can do a better job because we really can get down to a resolution of 1 millimeter or maybe less if we really wanted to. It's going to be dependent on about how much on the dose of how much of this tracer you actually want to give somebody. There's limits on the amount of radiation that you can inject into someone. There's limits on the amount of the stuff that's taken up into the brain, right? If it's glucose, it's only going to be taken up for a certain period of time into regions of the brain that are active. So that's important too, the number of detectors and just the sensitivity of the detectors themselves. There's going to be a lot of things that we throw out, events that we throw out because we're not sure whether they're actual annihilation events or where they happen. Yeah, there's one other thing in this list. This is sort of you can make it quantitative in PET imaging if you think about all of these things very carefully and you know a lot of math about this. There's another one that's very important here, and that's dead time. So these scintillating detectors, the annihilation events happen very, very rapidly, and the detectors have to essentially find an event and then sort of reset themselves after the gamma ray, the photon, just dissipates. And so there's some limit as well on how fast each of the detectors can detect another event. And that stops the sensitivity of PET as well, because there's just limits on what these crystals can actually do. And they've gotten a lot better lately, but that's still a big limitation as well. So lots of things that are stopping this from being more sensitive than it could be. Different tracer compounds that are used. Most of them are carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and fluorine, all the molecules in the body that we can actually connect stuff to. Fluorine we use as an analog to hydrogen, so it'll be taken up in any of the areas of the brain where hydrogen is, so that's useful. And half-life refers to the time that it takes for 50% of the material to break down. So if I put in a radio tracer into an artery, how long does it take before 50% of the molecules actually lose their tracer and annihilation events occur? This changes a lot depending on what you use. So if you actually want to measure oxygen, the half-life is about 1.5 minutes. That means in 1.5 minutes you have to get the stuff from the cyclotron, out of the cyclotron, connect it to whatever your vehicle is, and get it over to the PET scanner, and you have to get it into the person. So the way that we do this is actually by inhalation. So they put it into a gas, and the person puts a mask on, and they breathe the stuff in. And it's very fast, it's very effective, because the brain needs lots of that stuff. But it's very difficult to work with because of these fast half-lives. Carbon is 10 minutes, so that's a pretty useful one. It's at least long enough that it gives you a fighting chance. It's been used actually in a lot for dopamine, looking at things like, for example, dopamine receptors and the distribution of receptors for studies on the uptake of cocaine. So it's been used to label cocaine, to look at distributions of cocaine uptake. And fluorine is one that we use a lot because the half-life is 109 minutes. So we really actually, the stuff that I was using when I was at University of British Columbia was fluorine. It's 2-deoxyglucose, so FDG. It's the most common kind of imaging that's done. And our cyclotron was 1.5 miles away from the PET scanner. And we had one of those fast tubes, what do you call them? Like at the bank. Yeah. And it zipped this thing 1.5 miles through a tube that was underground. It was the stupidest setup on the face of the earth, I thought, but it worked. And so, but we could do it because we could get it there in a little bit of time, and then we could get the person ready in the scanner and put the stuff in. You want to do it as quickly as possible because it's breaking down that whole time, but you have longer to before you have to get it into the individual, and you have a longer time where you have the person doing an experiment, right? So if it's oxygen and it's 1.5 minutes, by the time it gets in there, you have very little of it left, and you might have them do an experiment for 10 seconds. And then on the, but on when you're using fluorine, you can have them do an experiment that lasts about 20 minutes or so. In fact, you have to, because the stuff is breaking down so slowly that it's going to take that long to get enough annihilation events. Yeah.
Is there any way to have some kind of continuous stream of the oxygen or something, so you can get longer periods of time to work with it?
That's what you do. It's very difficult to figure out how to do that, but what you'll do is you'll have just, it's almost like event-related experiments in fMRI. So they take a dose of it, they do a few seconds of the experiment, you let it clear, and then you do it again, and you let it clear. So in most PET scan studies, there are multiple boluses of the injections or of the inhalations and multiple experiments that you combine together. Yeah. But it's still difficult to do it, but you can do that. Yeah.
What's the difference in radiation based on the half-life or the dose? Like if you did a dose of the fluorine one as opposed to multiple doses of the oxygen?
I'm no expert on this, but I know that people have worked out exactly what the radioactive doses are and what the limits are and how much you're allowed to give an individual.
Okay.
And it's worked out based on body size and all kinds of stuff. So I'm not an expert on that, but they have clear limits on how much you can actually give to people. This is a neat example that came out of a lab in Phoenix a few years ago, Eric Ryman, and he's using a FDG PET. And what he's looking at is glucose metabolism in patients with Alzheimer's disease compared to normal controls, so older adults compared to normal controls. And what you see, it's not a big surprise, by the way, that you have decreases in this. The next one is the surprise, not this one, but you have to look at this one first. So decreases in the lateral temporal lobe, and in the big swath of the parietal lobe, that L shape that we see in early Alzheimer's disease, and also extending into this posterior cingulate region on the medial surface. But what was really neat was then he did this with the same study with individuals who are homozygotes, meaning people who have the genetic risk for Alzheimer's disease, two copies of the apolipoprotein E4 allele, but they are cognitively normal. So they were in their 40s, and so they had no inkling of any cognitive impairments. And now you can compare these three groups, normal older adults who do not have genetic risk, early Alzheimer's patients, and these individuals who have genetic risk for Alzheimer's. So you saw the purple before. Here it is again, right? And now what you see is the blue. Can you see the blue laid over top? Those are the regions of decreases in metabolic rate for the individuals who are homozygote for the APOE4 allele. You don't have to do statistics here. You can see that they're laying right over top of the regions that are showing the metabolic decline in Alzheimer's patients. There are some other regions too, predominantly in the frontal lobe, all across the frontal lobe. These are regions where you see metabolic decline in these at-risk individuals in comparison to the normal controls. And so this is what we see in older adults, is a decline in metabolism in the frontal lobe. And so it might be that homozygotes, the apolipoprotein E4 allele, is sort of adding two things. It's kind of accentuating the normal aging process in these frontal regions, but it's also decreasing metabolic rate in regions that perfectly overlap with Alzheimer's. And in fact, in the follow-up study to this is 1996, in the follow-up study to this, two of these individuals went on to be given a diagnosis of MCI, mild cognitive impairment, and they were the individuals who had the greatest degree of metabolic decline in these regions. So they were the ones who looked the most like Alzheimer's disease. So I think you were asking about whether we can use imaging to actually diagnose Alzheimer's disease. This kind of stuff might be much more sensitive than looking at structural MR, and that's why people are very interested in using PET in these kinds of studies. I'll show you, that's activation. You don't want to see that one. I'll show you one more that's related to Alzheimer's. This is the other one that people are so interested in now. There's a compound, it's a complicated compound, but we call it PIB. It's the Pittsburgh Imaging Compound. And what it does is it labels plaques in the brain. So it is a way of actually measuring with a PET scanner the number or amount of plaque burden, and plaque being one of the major components of the pathology associated with Alzheimer's disease. So this is an image of an older adult who does not have dementia. They're cognitively normal, and not surprisingly, there's nothing in the brain that the green is going to be the PIB uptake. And there's nothing in there because normal older adults really don't have a big high burden of plaque. And this is an Alzheimer's patient with dementia, and you can see that the whole cortex is covered in plaque. Some interesting things about this, now they're doing this with more and more people, and what they're finding is that there's a significant group, about maybe 1 in 5 older adults, who may not have, they don't have this much plaque, but they have uptake, a significant amount of uptake in various regions of the brain, but they're cognitively normal at that point. So two things could be. One is that plaques have nothing to do with Alzheimer's, which some people have said for a long time. But the other could be that it's an early marker, and that the cognitive impairments sort of, that the PIB uptake will predate the actual onset of the cognitive impairments. So these kinds of things might be really the big use of for PET instead of doing functional studies like we do with fMRI. It's just so much more difficult to do functional studies with PET that most people have given up on it. The problem with this, the last thing I'll say, is that this is great, but it has been so difficult to create these labeled markers for uptake and get ones that last long enough that they can actually be taken up in the brain. So it's been more useful in animal studies than it has been in humans, but some of this stuff might become really, really important to us. So, yeah.
Sorry. So in the past, you said you talked about people with Alzheimer's disease versus people without. Can't Alzheimer's disease only be truly diagnosed after death?
Yes.
So how are they going about labeling those people for these studies?
Okay. So all of the people, when this is a normal individual with Alzheimer's, an older adult with Alzheimer's, I should put before that the word probable.
Okay.
Probable Alzheimer's. When we do neuropsych evaluations and we see a particular pattern of memory impairment and several other types of cognitive dysfunction, we'll say that person has probable Alzheimer's disease. And in fact, we're about 95% correct when we come to post that the brain actually has plaques and tangles. Sometimes they surprise us, and it's something else like multi-infarct dementia or something like that, but we're pretty good at it. But technically, I should always say probable Alzheimer's when I'm talking about someone who hasn't come to post. Yeah, but this is the holy grail, right? This is this one back here in particular that Eric Ryman's doing. I mean, to be able to identify people who may go on to develop Alzheimer's before there is cognitive impairment, that's really what we want to do, because the fact is that by the time we can actually do the neuropsych testing and say that somebody has Alzheimer's, there is so much damage in the brain and it's so extensive that it's highly unlikely that we're ever going to develop treatments that can reverse that damage. So what you want to do is back up the diagnosis so that you identify these people as early as possible and you can create treatments that will either stop the disorder from continuing or at least slow the progression. And there's lots of evidence, including the stuff from Eric Ryman's lab, that suggests that these changes are happening maybe even in your 40s. Kind of scary. But not to everybody. So even if you have the E4 allele, not everybody's going to go on to develop Alzheimer's disease. And lots of people will get Alzheimer's who don't have genetic risk, or at least that we can measure, that we know about right now. So we're looking to lots of these imaging methods to try and identify those people earlier on. Yeah?
It's true that some people who have died of old age and were autopsied had a lot extensive plaques and tangles, but had never developed any form of cognitive impairment.
Right. Well, yes. And so we're seeing that with the PIB imaging as well. And every once in a while, we don't know what the numbers are, because the truth is that nobody does the autopsies on people who are cognitively normal. But every once in a while, for some reason, they're added in as a control. They're cognitively normal, and yet they have all of these plaques and tangles, which has led some people to say plaques and tangles are not the important thing. There's something else in the pathology that we haven't figured out. The alternative is that individual did have cognitive impairment, but you didn't pick it up yet. We know, for example, you know this statistic, it's a really good thing that you're all getting PhDs, because it decreases significantly your risk for developing Alzheimer's disease. That's true, and it's very well documented. The higher the education, the less likely you are to develop Alzheimer's. Is that because you're working your brain in some magical way that makes it healthier? Maybe. But it could also be that you have what's been described as cognitive reserve. So you are smarter, and you have more strategies and more ways of dealing with difficulty than somebody who hasn't had a higher education level. So if you go on to develop Alzheimer's later on in life, what we will see in your brain in comparison to someone with, say, a high school education, is that you actually have more pathology than the individual who was diagnosed with AD at a lower level of education. You see what I mean? So it could be that you, being the clever people that you are able to actually sustain your a reasonable level of cognitive function in the presence of this pathology. That's one possibility. The other one that people are interested in is that somehow, even in the presence of the pathology, that using your brain, staying cognitively active, actually confers some extended health to the remaining neurons. That's a possibility too. And that because most people with higher education tend to remain more cognitively active throughout their lifespan. And so it could be one or the other, or it could be a combination of both. We don't know why, but it's absolutely true. Some people come to POST and they have lots of Alzheimer's type pathology in the brain. Any other questions? I think that's enough, don't you?
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
So, I think we'll call it a day.
Look, I got you out early.
Well, they will still be running ligands down from Phoenix for the clinical scan.
There's a PET scan on Campbell.
I want to